It's Jennifer Diane Gostin, and welcome to Once Upon a Time in Adoptee Land. Wouldn't it be empowering to have many of your burning questions answered here? This week wraps up the third of three guests who authored Adoption Unfiltered, Revelations from Adoptees, Birth Parents, and Allies, released December 1st, 2023. Sarah Easterly, an adoptee, was a guest on here during season 10, and Lori Holden, an adoptive parent, was a guest during season 9. Now it's time, and my absolute pleasure, for you to hear from the youngest member of the trio, Kelsey Vandervliet Renyard, a birth mom. We start off the recording sharing a fun fact about us from the past. Then we quickly delve right into her contribution to Adoption Unfiltered, Part 2, Birth Parents Unfiltered, and what that collaborative effort has meant to her. I learned from Kelsey and 18 other birth mothers through their words how it feels to sign away one's parental rights. In this episode, Kelsey shares a part of her journey of relinquishing a son 8 years ago to an open adoption. There are things she didn't know would come up for her through the years with that decision, and hopes to shed light on how birth moms can be aware of receiving or being given important information and full disclosure about an open adoption. On page 44, Kelsey wrote with regard to an open adoption, "Being an outsider is a persistent gut feeling for birth mothers. Nevertheless, we carry a responsibility to stick around through the awkward times. However, sometimes birth mothers don't have a rebuttal for the voices in their heads urging them to run. The remedy for this is not always simple, but a commitment is required by all. Transparent and informative pre-adoption education, effective and continuing post-placement support, and an adoptive family that doesn't give up on them. Birth mothers must be told they are not a fleeting particle, but instead an essential piece of the composition that is this child's opportunity to feel safe." At her youthful age of 31, Kelsey works on domestic adoption policy matters for nonprofit. She is the co-host of the First Birth Mom podcast, Twisted Sisterhood, with Ashley Mitchell. There, they both share how others can learn from them about what open adoption looks like from their perspective and experience. And they don't sugarcoat their answers. Allow me to introduce to you someone who lives in Northern California with her husband and daughter. As a published author, fellow podcaster, adoption reform activist, and wearing many other hats, she seems to pull it off effortlessly. Yet we know there's nothing easy about it. She is young enough to be my daughter and has shown a tenacity based on her personal choices to take on one of the most sensitive subjects on the planet, relinquishment and adoption in the world we live in today. Kelsey, I have been looking forward to this time with you and having a conversation for the podcast. Welcome to Once Upon a Time in Adoptee Land. How you doing?
Good. I'm really happy to be on with you. It's taken a while to schedule it, and I apologize, but I'm really excited.
No apologies needed. I mean, you, Lori, and Sarah have been on the move along with whatever else you have going on in your life. I can only imagine how full your days are. I think I want to start with a fun fact. When I talked to you on the phone a few days ago, we were just kind of getting a little bit of each other's background. And you mentioned Oak Park, Illinois. And for my listeners, I just want you to know it's a suburb west of Chicago, like northwest. And it is one of the places that if I could have lived outside of the city during my career, that's where I would have lived. And so Kelsey shared with me that she was born in Oak Park. And I said, oh, really? And so then I said, my son was born there. And I asked her how old she was. And she said she was born in 93. That's right, right?
Yeah.
I said, my son was born in 90. So you're right there with his generation. And he was born at West Suburban. And she said, I was born at West Suburban Hospital. And I immediately thought, this is so cool. Because when we take time to get to know a person better. It's amazing how many things that connect us. And certainly that was endearing to me because West Suburban at the time was a brand new hospital in the 90s and just the best place to give birth. I can only imagine your mom was kind of thrilled to be in that place. So,
yeah, she always has talked about how great of an experience it was at West Suburban. So, yeah, it's so cool to have that connection.
Yeah, for real. I mean, that place, real quick, was like a hotel room. Like, I had never seen anything like it. And so, of course, going through childbirth for the first time, it was the best environment to feel mm-hmm. as comfortable as possible. So I just wanted to give the listeners that fun fact. I've talked with Lori for the podcast and Sarah most recently. So to have you on the trio to kind of end with you as it relates to Adoption Unfiltered, revelations from adoptees, birth parents, adoptive parents, and allies, I think it's special. It's so much to your story and the words you wrote for part two of the book. I learned so much. It was so well done, so well organized, and I'm glad you were a part of it. I'd like to start there with the book and just that experience working with an adoptee and an adoptive parent, you being a first mom. Mm-hmm.
It was like such a once-in-a-lifetime experience and one I'm really grateful for. So much work. I think when I agreed to write the book with them, I didn't anticipate like how much work it would be. And I'm a hard worker. I work on a lot of things at once, but I had no concept of the level of work that would require, especially even after, you know, turning in the manuscript and after, you know, the publishing of the book. We're still working really hard on promoting the book, making sure people know about it, that it gets into the right hands. But it's been a really great experience, and we've really built a valuable, you know, relationships with each other through the process. Had the chance to, like, I don't know, like, walk the walk of what we wrote about, listening to one another, learning from each other, understanding each other on a deeper level. And those are all things that, yeah, I mean, hard work aside, like, I wouldn't trade, and really just feel really privileged and fortunate to have this experience.
I can imagine that it is like once in a lifetime to be able to collaborate with two other members of the constellation. And I think Sarah, when she says you three model what it looks like for mm-hmm. for the three parts to come together. So what are your thoughts about that? The modeling that you're able to do to show that it's so possible.
Well, first of all, we didn't come to this working group as, you know, we didn't have relationships with one another. I generally knew of Lori. I did not know Sarah. They didn't really know me. And they kind of barely knew each other as well, Lori and Sarah. So we started from scratch. It wasn't like we were all friends beforehand, which allowed us to really like get into the, we kind of operated from this place of like, we want to put this book out in the world that we know is important. But what we didn't understand is like how we would need to collaborate on a deeper level as well. And so I think some of those things were just the process of getting to know one another, getting to know each other's quirks and sensitivities, how we communicate. And really that process is, it's, you know, relationships 101, meeting each other where they are, seeing them for who they are, you know, eye to eye. You know, it wasn't without conflict, but the conflict was mitigated through mutual respect and understanding. And so we were able to get to this space where we love and respect each other, and we really fight for each other as well in our sides, and because of the relationship that we've allowed ourselves to discover, because all three sides, so typically, and there's more than three sides, but our three sides as like a birth mom, an adopted mom, and an adoptee, we typically exist in our separate silos. And I think that with those silos comes a lot of community, it comes a lot of understanding and validation, and there can be a lot of support. And I think there are really necessary communities to be in on your own. However, when we don't ever cross collaborate, I do think that we are vulnerable to being misunderstood, misunderstanding each other. And there's a lot of work that can be done that we're missing out on when we don't work together. So, yeah.
Wow, that was so good. Yeah, cross collaboration, I think, is very important to understanding one another. And I do think that conflict, when you can resolve it, it actually strengthens the relationship. So that's what it sounds like you're saying, and that you discovered how to work together. And I've experienced that too, as I talk to first moms, birth moms, original moms. I use all three. Do you use all three?
I use birth mom for myself, but I really am not, for my personal preference, I'm really not bothered by the language of it. I really do defer, like, however my child wants to address me, like, I'll fall in line. And I kind of take that position for everyone else too. It's like, you know, I, for me, I know my experience. I know that some women feel very dismissed by the term birth mom. I think that's great. Like, you use whatever term you feel most comfortable with. But I personally, I just say birth mom because it's the most recognizable term in society. I don't really have a preference. So.
Right. Yeah. That's what I get a lot from birth moms, that, yeah, call me birth mom. I like all three terms. So I use them. I don't know, whatever pops in my head at the moment. But yeah, when I get an opportunity to work with a birth mom, it's like I do get more understanding. Like, I gravitate to birth moms, I think, because I do just want to know their perspective, their experience, what really comes up for them. And I think a lot of that has to do with the fact that my birth mom was deceased when I learned of her identity. So anytime I talk with a birth mom, I feel like I maybe learn a little bit more about her story, if that makes sense. Yeah.
Sarah expressed to me during you know, our work together, that talking to me helped her contextualize her birth mom, even though she has a relationship with her and everything. Sometimes there's that invisible barrier between us at times that it's hard to break through. And sometimes, you know, people don't say everything that's going in their mind. So there's a lot that's left unspoken. And so Sarah did tell me that she felt a lot of times talking to me and me being able to express myself and not feeling, you know, inhibited in doing so, there were conversations that we had that felt very healing to her because it was, you know, fostering that understanding of the other side.
Yeah, I agree with that. And in reading part two that you wrote for the book, Adoption Unfiltered, paragraph on page 105, where you state, as you read part two, I hope you see these birth parents as the humans they are, moving beyond the simplicity of what a birth mother is. I hope you discover all the complexities of who these women are. There are no rainbows and butterflies here, but there is wisdom and power, and most of all, love and perseverance for a better future in adoption. I love that paragraph, and I think it does sum up what I came away thinking and feeling about your words.
Oh, thank you. The closed era is the closed adoption era is a big reason for this, but birth parents are often a figment of people's imagination. We hear about the stork dropping off children, you know what I mean? So we're not really many times willing to look beyond the flowery story of how this child came to be in this family. And so oftentimes we get literally written out of the story, but that doesn't mean that our children, and oftentimes too, their parents aren't wondering, what are we like? Who are we? What is it that we handed down to our kids? And And I wanted people to search for that information and find a richer story than what's been told for us.
Very good. And I want to come back to Adoption Unfiltered, but for now, I'd like you to share from wherever you want to start a part of your journey as a birth mom.
Yeah. So adoption's been a part of my life, my entire life. I was raised by an adoptee, and I'm also the fourth consecutive person in my family to like relinquish a child for adoption, terminate my parental rights. In many ways, that's felt like a kind of a family curse, but also I do feel like my relinquishment experience has really been a catalyst for our family to kind of re-examine these experiences that we've had and think about things on a deeper level. There's been a lot of healing that our family has done and is still doing. We're not done. As a result of my experience, partly because I am very much the type of person that refuses to deal with things silently. I'm a big talker and I like to think out loud. And so when I was in deep, dark grief, I was very vocal about that. And so it forced people around me to confront those realities instead of do what we had been doing for a century, I guess, and pushing things aside and trying to tell people to forget about it. So my dad was an adoptee or is an adoptee, and his birth mom was adopted as well. It's just been this theme of my life, and then not something we really thought about until I was facing an unplanned pregnancy and decided to pursue adoption. That experience led me to, then I got a job and I worked in an adoption agency for a year and a half, and that changed everything for me. I saw so many things in the adoption field that needed to be changed urgently. That really set me on a path of advocacy and activism. And so where I'm at now is that I personally, I have an open adoption with my son. I'm just about 8 years post-placement, so I'm relatively still very fresh and new in this space. I'm the director of policy and advocacy at Ethical Family Building, which is a nonprofit in Los Angeles that promotes oversight, transparency, and protections for people involved in adoption, namely adoptees, birth parents, and adoptive parents. So, yeah.
Well, thank you for that. Yeah, like 8 years into placement seems relatively new to me. You said that, right? And so there's still like a lot you're navigating about it. And and I really appreciate you sharing that working at an adoption agency set into motion this need to be an activist, you know, a part of advocating for change and improvement in adoption. And so I know you've done a lot of work in that area. You want to talk about that?
Sure. I work on legislative issues, both federal and state. I pursue enforcement of laws that are already existing that aren't being enforced and therefore are being violated. And that's typically in a state jurisdiction. So I'm pursuing enforcement like currently in Ohio and Virginia with my team. And I certainly don't do any of this alone. I have a really great team that I work with and like attorneys, and I'm not an attorney myself, but I have people that are willing to use their legal expertise and work miracles. And so I'm working on a federal bill at the moment called the Adopt Act, which is Adoption Deserves Oversight, Protection, and Transparency Act, and it would prohibit unlicensed intermediaries from providing adoption services and advertising their services, a bill that we worked hard on last year in 2023 through a kind of a convoluted way, got passed through the California legislature to end 27 long years of allowing unlicensed adoption facilitators from providing adoption services. And that went into effect on January 1st of this year. I know there's more, but like those are the most significant things legislatively. I do a lot of work with the media to pitch certain stories. People, we've kind of become this unofficial place of where people bring their stories of what's happened to them with, you know, unjust adoption practices. And so we've been a part of some major news articles to shine a light on these issues, to make the state aware of the issues, make the federal government aware. And so that's something I'm really passionate about, is making sure that this process of adoption isn't transactional. We have a really long way to go to make that happen, but that's something I'm really committed to.
Well, congratulations. Yeah. Like when I was reading your part in the book, I was really very disappointed to hear about all of the unlicensed agencies mm-hmm. operating in this country. Like, I guess I just assumed that they would be all licensed. And to know that you've been able to make changes already as it relates to that. And I was able to listen to a recent episode. It might be the latest one out on the podcast that you do with Lori and Sarah, the Adoption Unfiltered podcast. And it was with Betsy Norris. So,
yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, Betsy has been helping me out a ton in Ohio with the enforcement action. And so I love Betsy, and I'm really grateful that I get to work alongside her.
Yeah, that was a great episode. I like her too. I've known her for many years, and she's been a guest on my podcast. And I was happy to see her be interviewed by you three. It was really good.
Yeah.
You also are on another podcast with Ashley Mitchell for Twisted Sisterhood. How has that experience been?
Great. We started film recording the podcast in 2020, like January 2020. So, of course, we didn't have foresight to know what would happen that year, but it's been great. We saw a need for that kind of a resource. We encourage women to attend support groups in person or virtually, and we encourage women to get therapy and counseling if that's something that they feel they would benefit from. There was nothing really besides a few books that were out that could help them deal with some of the modern issues of open adoption and just this whole experience that they could like listen to in private and keep up on. And so we saw that gap, and I'm biased, I guess. I personally think we've done a great job of doing that. It became quite popular with birth moms, and so I'm really glad that we can provide that resource for them. Yeah, but we're not super consistent about posting. We're not super professional with it. I think we just both got a lot going on, but we're still putting out our third season right now. And so there's still really good episodes on there that we're putting out. We don't feel like we've run out of content by any means.
I had the opportunity to listen to the episode titled Roles, Rights, and Responsibilities, which I thought was so well done. And hearing from both of you and that whole navigation of open adoption and openness in adoption. And I think, I'm pretty sure it was Lori that I heard it first from, what openness means versus open. What are your thoughts about that?
I think it connects so many questions to the answers in so many ways. For a long time, we were, you know, talking about open adoption in terms of contact and level of contact. And a lot of times adoptive parents would be like, yeah, but like, I don't have access to this mom. You know, maybe she's not alive anymore. Maybe she's kind of disappeared, went off the map. I don't have access to this. How do I can't have open adoption. And so they think, oh, this doesn't apply to me. And if it doesn't, you know, if it doesn't apply, let it fly. And I think that was like, there's got to be something else that you can be doing if you don't have access to contact. And so the way Lori started explaining openness, it was like, this is the thing. This is the thing that connects it. And this is the thing that serves the adoptee. I think the way that we've been looking at open adoption even has been so wrong. We've been looking at open adoption as if it's like this favor done to the birth parent, or as if it's like repaying the birth mom for the adoption, which cannot do. And it doesn't, that's not the way we should be framing this at all. This open adoption is, you know, the openness is for the benefit of the child, for their comfort, for their security, for their well-being as an individual and as a member of their families and society. And so the way Lori frames it has been such a significant contribution to the adoption community. And I truly mean that, like such a significant monumental contribution to help parents reframe this in their mind, birth parents and adoptive parents alike, so that they have tangible ways to incorporate this into their relationships in adoption and with their child.
Yeah, I think it is a major contribution by Lori as well. And I'm looking at page 139 right now when you write, birth mothers who enter an open adoption after relinquishing their child typically have little knowledge of what the journey entails. This is partly because there is truly no way to know how all these individuals will grow over time. Still, it is perhaps more significantly due to the apprehension or outright refusal to educate expectant mothers. Pre-adoption education for adoptive parents gets a few things wrong about an open adoption and leaves many questions unanswered. But pre-adoption education for expectant parents who wish and plan to become involved birth parents is often bypassed altogether.
Yeah, this is something that I'm really passionate about, especially lately in the professional community. It's informed consent for expectant parents, and it's largely non-existent at this time. And I've really started placing a responsibility on the professionals' part to explore that. And what happens is they feel conflicted because they're like, well, we know this is the right thing to do, but what if she doesn't place? And then I think to myself, then you've informed her and she's declined consent. That is how it works.
Right.
That's the basis of informed consent. And so it's like, we're getting it little by little, but I mean, from a business perspective, when you have based your ability to survive as an organization off of these women relinquishing their children, you're in quite a pickle when it comes to being faced with doing the right thing as far as informed consent and pre-adoption education for expectant parents. And so I think the challenge lies in, okay, if we really have something significant to offer our community and the services we provide, we need to diversify what those services are. And how do we do that? And if we don't, we might not survive as an organization because the world is progressing in a different direction. And we need to make sure that we're doing right by the people that we're claiming to serve. And so I think this informed consent, I think we've just barely touched the tip of the iceberg with this conversation. But I know that there's way more to come on this front. I was just speaking with a longtime researcher and academic in adoption who's been publishing studies on adoption and adoptees for like decades. And she's presenting at the National Adoption Conference this summer on informed consent. And I was working with her on that. And she was like asking me, what do you think they're ready to hear? What do you think I should say? And I was like, give it all to them. That's how we move the needle. That's how we move the needle. And that is something I'm really excited about, that we're on the brink of talking about informed consent. Like I said, I'm 8 years post-placement. I've been doing activism in this space for almost 7 years, honestly. And the way that we've moved forward in those 7 years has been huge. And I think when I was first starting out, people were still arguing with me about open adoption in general and contact levels And we're so past it now. I don't feel like we're totally past it. We're not out of the woods yet, but things are moving at a much faster pace because of the accessibility of education and the knowledge that's at our fingertips. And so for one, I feel really hopeful for the way that the direction we're headed in. And some days I don't feel that way. Not every day is like that, but I do truly feel that there is change happening. So it's encouraging.
Yeah, I'm hopeful too. And I think it just takes all of us showing up and participating in the ways that we do. It's all so important. And everybody's contribution, I believe, is making a difference. And even though it may be moving slowly, slower than we like, I see change, and I'm very hopeful. That brings me to a question about what made you decide to be open, honest, and public about your experience.
Yeah, I think really I don't know how else to be. I think that it honestly is a personality thing. I remember growing up in my family, my parents are not super emotional on the outside, people. My mom's an accountant, and now my brother's an accountant. That's the kind of people I was raised with, and I love them dearly, but I did not. I was always told I was, oh, you're so emotional and you're so, you're so abstract. And as a kid, you're like, well, shoot, like I am I too much? But now I think like, when you are able to exercise that in a way that's productive and challenging to people in a really good way, I think there's space for that. And so I really chose to be public because I was in so much pain. I still feel a lot of pain. I think there's that level of pain that will never go away from this experience, but in so much pain, and the only way I had ever known how to express that was on the outside. That's always how I've been. And I've always been honest, and I'm terrible at lying. So this is me, That's why.
Yeah, that's a great answer. That would be kind of the way I would put it too, when I made the decision to be open, honest, and public about my experience as an adopted person. Have you experienced any challenges being connected to the adoption community?
Oh yeah, I think yes. So I think this adoption community is made up of a lot of people that are in a lot of pain. And that pain has gone very neglected and ignored by the larger society for forever, essentially. And so I think that when you have a lot of people that are hurting in one space, it can be very difficult. There's that like phrase like hurt people, hurt people. I'm sure I've hurt a lot of people with wielding my own pain, and it happens, in return as well. There's a lot of infighting that happens in activism spaces. There's people with different ideals and different ideas about what should this look like, and that's really any advocacy space in any policy area. Everybody believes that their way is the right way, including myself. I think at the same time, there's a reason I keep coming back to this community. This community has also been really life-saving for me, really supportive. In my whole life, I don't think I ever felt there was a place that I belonged as much as this adoption community. And so I feel that, with any relationships, you have good things and bad things or hard things to get through. And I think once I started looking for the people behind the hurt, I think it's become easier to be in this community despite the challenges and the difficulties of the conflict that happens. I think it's been easier since I take the time to try and understand people.
Right. Sounds like you remain very open.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's exactly how I feel. Yeah, it's highs and lows for sure. And to keep coming back suggests to me that the highs outweigh the lows.
Yeah.
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 I've been asking this question because I'm so intrigued by it, and I certainly don't want to put you on the spot because you don't know I'm going to ask you, so you feel free not to answer it. But I've been intrigued by the question of what would the person today in 2024 say to the one 10 years ago? And I've gotten some really great answers, but when I was thinking about you, and I think it's because you're younger, you know, a generation younger than me, I would phrase it this way. What would 2034 Kelsey, right? Future self, say to Kelsey in 2024?
That's a good question. I'll be in my 40s.
Let me just give a little background to the audience. I have a really good relationship with my future self. She's always talking to me like, okay, you know you want to work out because that's going to make you feel better and that's going to be a part of just your overall good health. In all kinds of areas, my future self talks to me. And my present self sometimes is like, well, I really don't want to do that. And my future self will say, yeah, but what does want to do it have to do with what it's going to do for you, right? So that's kind of where it's coming from.
That's interesting. I've never thought of that like that before, but I really do seek out mentorship, I guess, from people. One of them is my colleague, Celeste Liversidge. I'm not going to tell you how old she is because she'd flip out if she heard me telling how old she is, but, you know, she's older than me. She'd want me to say she's not old enough to be my mother, but she's older than me and has a lot of wisdom. And so I do seek that out quite a bit. But I think one thing I don't probably do is seek out that future self and that future voice of myself. So it's interesting perspective. Man, I hope I would give myself some grace because I think when I look back at any year prior to the one I'm in, I try to do that and try to give myself grace, you know, give myself some understanding of like, maybe you didn't know everything. You didn't know what you were getting into. You didn't have all the information. And so I think my future self, I hope what she looks back and says is like, you know, you did everything you could with what you had. And because I don't have the foresight to know if what I'm doing now will be successful, if I will get the results or the outcomes that I'm intending. And so I hope that when I look back on these years that I what I see is, you know, perseverance, you know, a general goodness to my community. So
yeah, that's a beautiful answer. And thank you for answering it on the spot.
Yeah, no problem.
Yeah, I look at my future self as being so wise, like wiser than the me now. And then someone said, well, the you now was once your future self. So you're kind of like one working, really working together, if not one and the same. So thank you for that. And I almost forgot you accepted my invitation to read something. So whenever you're ready.
Okay. So I'm going to be reading off of page 153. It's a section of the chapter 13 called Downstream Effects of Our Decision. And this section of the chapter is called Birth Mothers Grow Up Too. I don't know how long I'm going to read, but I just will just start. I've not read this excerpt for anybody before. I wanted to kind of give you a special one that I've not read out loud yet.
Well, thank you. And as much as you want to read would be great.
Okay. Birth mothers often have placed a child for adoption in a painful era of their lives. The age they were during that point in their life is forever associated with the loss of their child. It may feel conflicting for a birth mom to try and move forward with her life when grief continues to be experienced spontaneously and indefinitely. Kadra reflects on the challenge of looking backward while addressing grief in the present. The parts of my brain and heart that hold my son sort of stayed stuck as a 19-year-old girl. The times that my anxiety or grief gets the better of me, I feel myself turn into that 19-year-old worrier. Many birth mothers express that later in life, they realize they may have been able to parent the child they relinquished, proving to be a painful acceptance with added grief. Sarah describes her acceptance after a 20-year journey in open adoption. Growth is never without pain. What I have learned over the years about what I thought I had been empowered to choose has been very painful to uncover and come to terms with. Similarly, some birth mothers who later had other children they chose to parent have conflicting feelings about their losses and are often prompted to compare what they lost to what they have now. However, having other children and a limited relationship causes its own hardship, especially when siblings know of the adoptee's existence but do not have access to a relationship of their own. Melissa went on to have two children after the relinquishment of her son. As the adoption was closed when he was 5 years old, it was upsetting for her and her children as they could not have contact with their older brother. Melissa says, "I have always made sure that I talked to them about their big brother and to keep praying that we would get to meet him again one day." To young children, the legalities of relinquishment and adoption do not matter. They can experience real pain and confusion surrounding the loss of a sibling they may have never known. A birth mother's reconciliation with what was and what is can propel her forward into a potentially successful relationship with the adoptee. Our kids get big. They grow up and then they have their own kids. Then those kids have kids and the thread continues to weave. Birth mothers have a responsibility to their children, whether or not they live in our homes. Openness is a weight that birth parents carry as well.
I read along with you, and Kelsey, you're so wise. I'm so glad you were a part of writing Adoption Unfiltered. Thank you so much. Is there anything I didn't ask you that you'd like to share?
No, I think we covered it. Yeah.
I think so too. And I just so appreciate you taking the time. I don't know how you do it, but you do it. And maybe youth is part of it.
Yeah, I think I dropped the ball a lot in order to do it. But yeah, appreciated it.
Yeah, thank you so much for having this conversation. It's been great.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Kelsey being vulnerable when expressing her choice to be public as a birth mom who relinquished a child, in a word, is pain. In Adoption Unfiltered, she shares more about how frightening it is to currently be participating in an open adoption and writing about it. As far as the pain many people suffer within the adoption community, especially adoptees, I believe it can be a tricky space to navigate. There are always highs and lows, ebbs and flows with any group. Yet being aware of our pain points and leaning into healing feels like a starting point. That phrase, "Hurting people hurt people," resonates with me. It seems critical and necessary that if we can turn our pain into purpose, a shift is possible toward peace from within. We don't have to always agree to understand how someone else's personal decisions have impacted their other choices. We can choose to empathize while still honoring our belief system and those steps of action for changes we desire as we best see fit. I appreciated hearing Kelsey say that in her whole life, she didn't ever feel there was a place that she belonged as much as with the adoption community. She took the time to look for and understand the people behind the hurt. All of that resonates with me and is a reminder to stay open to what I don't know that I don't know. The audio version of Adoption Unfiltered, read by Sarah Easterly, is currently available, and I am eager to listen. And getting to hear Kelsey read a few of her words, I hope, was as big of a treat or bigger for you as it was for me. Thank you, Kelsey, for having this conversation with me. I felt your passion and wanting to make changes in all 50 states with legislation, and the hope you have in being a part of the solution for all members of the Constellation. I'm always in awe of the younger generation jumping into first gear to facilitate a movement forward. I'm sure your future self in 10 years is already thankful for you remaining true to you. If you're an adoptee and would like to share your adoption journey, visit JenniferDianeGolston.com. If you like Once Upon a Time in Adoptee Land, leave a review on Apple Podcasts. Follow and or give, hopefully, a 5-star rating so others can find it too. During the course of your day, I trust you will tell at least one friend or someone who you believe might find value in it, because word of mouth is still the very best way for the show to grow. If you seek to be an ally of the adoption community, I hope you will consider making a monthly donation of at least $5 or a one-time amount that works for you at patreon.com/adoptiland. Thank you for being here.